Ridge is the densely wooded first stretch of the Borrego Canyon Trail, a little finger of wilderness passing through typical Orange County subdivisions, the kind where the red tile roof houses all look the same, and the streets are gently curved to distract from the fact that the entire neighborhood was laid out on a single sheet of drafting paper. Beyond the first stretch, the houses fall away and the trail rises into the drier hills beyond. If all goes well, his new patient will never get that far. He hears her footfalls behind him. Sluggish slaps against the concrete, turning crunchy when they hit the dirt. He keeps his back to her as she passes, makes sure his baseball cap is secure. He's taken care to pull most of the threads from the logo on the cap's brim, a logo for some medical supply company whose name he can't even remember, a giveaway he got at some conference years before. Now the brim bears a few loose loops of blue thread, confusing enough to throw off a potential witness should they try to describe it later. Every minute said witness spends wondering what sports team the hat promoted is another minute he gets to work in peace, without distractions. As tempting as it is to check the contents of his fanny pack, he can't do that now. Not out in the open like this. Instead, he grips the outside and gives it a little shake, as if he's just making sure the thing's secured to his hip. It allows him to feel the lumps made by the ball gag and the 10-millimeter syringe containing his special blend of ketamine, Versed, and propofol. After a few minutes on the trail, he spots her. She's already losing steam, probably because she took off too fast. Her chocolate-brown ponytail is swaying when it should be bouncing, and she's glistening with sweat. He's never run up behind a patient in this way, and he's pleasantly surprised by the delicious tensions inherent in the act. By the multiple contrasts, waiting and the exertion, simultaneous assessment of the trail ahead and behind, of the thickness of the brush on either side, of his speed which must stay steady without giving away that he's slowly gaining on her. He feels like a wolf and a snake in one, or a snake riding on the back of a wolf, waiting for the right moment to strike. A ridiculous image, even if it is a fitting metaphor. He has to hold back laughter. When you become this good at something, he thinks, that's a sign it's exactly what you should be doing. It's time. He can feel it. His cock can feel it. He's desperately hard. The light is fading, lacing the shade from the branches overhead with threads of true darkness. The brush on either side of the trail is as thick as he needs it to be. And it's quiet, save for their twin interposed footfalls. Another minute or two and she'll notice him. Another few minutes after that, and the trail will rise and the brush will thin out. It's now or never. Or more accurately, it's now or start over, and he doesn't want to start over. He can't start over. She failed the test. It's decided. After a deep, steadying breath, the man they call the Mask Maker accelerates. He pulls the Talon airweight baton from the thigh holster hidden underneath his running pants. With the press of a button, he extends the baton to its full length. Before she notices him, inches behind her, he brings it down across the woman's upper back with enough force to send her face first into the dirt, her breath coming out of her in a desperate, ineffectual wheeze. That sounds nothing like a scream. 27. When Julia Crispin was 19 years old, she was raped at knife point inside her parked car after leaving a bonfire on Mission Bay. It was the summer before her sophomore year at Yale, and when she returned to school a few months later, she brought with her a long, slender scar that snakes along her jugular vein to a spot an inch or two beneath her collarbone. On her left side. Julia is 57 now, and the CEO of Crispin Corp, one of the most successful surveillance technology companies in the world. Like Cole, she inherited her business from her father. Unlike Cole, she has considerably more experience in the CEO position, a fact of which she never fails to remind him. She's a handsome woman with a long, fine-boned face, pale, freckled skin, deep-set blue eyes, and dark eyebrows that always make her appear as if she's finishing up a frown. For as long as Cole's known her, she's worn her hair in a platinum Jackie O bob. The scar's still with her, and it has a tendency to peek above the collars of the lustrous silk blouses she favors. She's never made an effort to conceal it with makeup. It's like she's daring people to ask her about it. Or better yet, reminding them of what she's survived. Cole can see the top half of it now, and he'd rather focus on it than the stoic expression on her face as she watches the micro-drone surveillance footage of Charlotte Rowe and Luke Prescott taken that afternoon. She's watching the footage on a tablet he brought her, which his tech team assured him was air-gapped, meaning never connected to the internet. It's also been stripped of any drive or device that could support a cellular or Wi-Fi connection. They transferred the footage onto it the old-fashioned way with a portable hard drive. Julia's office is carved out of the earth underneath her sprawling glass-and-steel mansion in Rancho Santa Fe, which means it offers no view of the horses she keeps in the stable, or the snaking front drive lined with willows and precisely placed beds of wildflowers. Down here, an ignorant visitor might assume the glass walls are designed simply to make the banks of television screens behind them disappear once they're turned off. But the glass hides more than the televisions. Behind them is another set of walls, steel-encased, with enough electromagnetic shielding to deflect the surveillance efforts of the NSA. It saddens him a bit that Julia's office bears no photographic evidence of her accomplishments. No framed photos of her shaking hands with presidents or other CEOs. Just dark glass walls, recessed, pinpoint track lights that can be made bright enough to simulate sunlight, spindly steel and glass furniture like the uncomfortable chair he's sitting in now, and the persistent flicker of CNN, Fox, MSNBC, and Bloomberg News. But when your life's work is developing cameras and recording devices that are all but invisible, maybe it's bad form to broadcast your accomplishments. "Is that a tree?" Julia asks without looking up from the tablet. "Yes," Cole answers. She's kicking over a tree with one foot. "It's not a very big tree." "I can see how big it is, and the man watching her?" "A police officer with the Altamira Sheriff's Department. His name's Luke Prescott. They were high school classmates." "And she's showing him what she can do," Julia says. "Lovely." When she reaches the end of the video, she sets the tablet down face up. A tiny gesture, but one that seems to challenge the veracity, or at least the importance, of what she's just seen. "Microdrones took these?" she asks.
"Yes."
"Not ours, I presume."
"If they were yours, I wouldn't have lost four of them when the wind picked up, and I'd still be able to see her after dark."
"I'm flattered. It is hard to find good help these days, isn't it?"
"Why do you think I'm here?"
"Better microdrones?"
"Let's talk about the footage."
"I'm supposed to believe this woman is on Zyprexin."
"I think it's worth taking a closer look, don't you?"
"Where's Dylan now?"
"He's got a hideout in Arizona, a little tract house outside Tucson. I'm sure the neighbors don't know who he is or what he's done."
"And the reason we're not busting the doors down and stealing the pill from him?"
"He says he'll destroy it if we try. When I met with him, he said he'd set up some sort of incinerator that would burn the supply he had as well as all his research if he didn't get back to wherever he'd hidden them by a certain time."
"So he's modified Zyprexin's formula since you shut down Project Bluebird."
"Since we shut down Project Bluebird, yes," Cole reminds her.
"He's not using the formula we have. So if we want to wash our hands of this, we'd also have to wash our hands of any chance of seeing this drug work, and then we'd be left to deal with this Charlotte Rowe on our own. Which means we might have to wash our hands of her as well.
If we have the stomach for it. Suddenly it's we again?
Yes, well, we disagreed on how Dylan should have been dealt with when he walked away overnight.
This safe house. Is he refining the pills there? It doesn't look like it. I think he's got a lab or a storehouse somewhere, but he's stayed put since making contact with us. Wherever the place is, I'm guessing somewhere in Arizona. When he goes for it, we'll follow him.
But he hasn't gone for it. Cole shakes his head.
Why am I not looking at video of him, by the way? Julia asks. Because he can't kick over a tree with one foot.
That we know about.
So you had him followed after your meeting?
I did.
And we spoke again after, and he agreed to download a tracker to his phone. It was my condition.
Your condition for what?
I'm not proposing a relaunch of Project Bluebird, Julia.
Not yet, anyway. What are you proposing?
A closer look. That's all.
So is this just a friendly warning that you've been seduced by Dylan again? If she's not willing to play around, there's no reason he should either.
I need true glass.
Julia stiffens, carefully removes her glasses. Maybe it's a subconscious gesture triggered by the mention of her most potentially revolutionary invention, or maybe the gesture's simply designed to maximize the impact of her sudden glare. True glass is a prototype, Cole.
You expect me to believe it's been a prototype for 7 years?
You have spies inside my company.
I had my father in your bed every other weekend until he died.
Well, isn't that charming? I didn't realize he was working for you.
What's charming, your affair or my candor?
You mobilized millions in capital to finance the crazy experiments of a handsome Navy SEAL who fucked you 3 ways from Sunday.
You willingly contributed your millions when I showed you a rat tearing the head off a python in 10 seconds.
Julia sits back in her chair and smiles at her lap. Cole can't tell if it's humility or anger that's inspired these gestures.
I'm not judging you for what happened between you and my dad. Over and over and over again. In fact, I find it kind of comforting.
How's that exactly?
It's a testament to Dad's character, really. That he married the bimbo but screwed around with a woman of substance and accomplishment on the side.
That's a hell of a way to talk about your mother.
Standing up for my mother's integrity has never been your job, Julia. But again, I'm not judging you.
Then what are you doing?
When you try to dismiss your genuine interest in Zyprexin as solely the result of some deception I foisted upon you because I was cock-whipped by Dylan Cody, you leave me no other choice.
This doesn't seem to faze her, so he crosses his arms and lets the fingers on his left hand come to rest atop the spot where her scar resides. He taps 3 fingers along his collarbone several times to make his point.
If she gets it, she doesn't let on.
You realize we all have our contingency plans, right? She says. Should any of this ever come back to bite us in the ass?
As do I.
I have satellites on that island 24/7. Any ship gets within 200 nautical miles of it, I get detailed manifest information in 20 minutes.
We all need friends with satellites.
I'm serious, Cole.
I know, and I feel bad for you because it sounds boring and repetitive. Get a hobby, Julia. There's nothing left on that island for anyone to find.
But there might be again soon, is what you're saying, isn't it? Provided you like what you see once you get a closer look at this Charlotte Rowe and whatever Dylan's convinced her to do.
Provided we like what we see.
We.
You, me, Stephen, and Philip.
Right. But you're not suggesting a relaunch of the consortium.
Not yet. No.
Not until I give you true glass.
It will help me make a determination about the potential next steps. How's that? The problem, Cole, is that I'm not just giving it to you. I'm giving it to Charlotte Rowe, about whom I know nothing other than she can stop a truck with one arm and kick over a small tree with one foot. I brought you a file. It's interesting reading. I'm sure. But will any of it tell me whether or not she can be trusted with my most valuable piece of technology? No. Then the answer's no. 4 willing test subjects failed miserably. And apparently another one Dylan tested on his own, a woman, so gender isn't the deciding factor. But for some reason, it's working like clockwork in Charlotte Rowe, and we're not sure why. Dylan knows. Why did he pick her? He has a theory, but that's all. And he's got some clear biases around her that will become evident once you read her file. We need a closer look, Julia. Bring her in. If we bring her in, we take ownership of her. We take ownership of Dylan's problems and his mistakes. Right now, we should just watch, support, and learn.
This isn't just about surveillance, is it? She asks.
This is about showing her what you're capable of. You want to impress this girl with my invention. Dylan and I are working 2 different angles. He used a lot of vinegar. I plan to use more honey.
True glass isn't a party favor.
That is not the honey to which I'm referring.
And if she takes my invention and runs to the press with it?
I'll stop her, Cole says. Quickly.
She taps her fingers on the folder, as if the mere act of opening it now will constitute an unacceptable surrender to Cole's request.
Ah, this is giving me a headache. I hate headaches. I'd rather be stabbed in the stomach than have a headache. You'd prefer Dylan to be out in the wild on this on his own? Honestly, I'm not just assessing how we might all benefit from this. I'm also containing it.
There's nothing connecting any of us to what he's done with this woman. Maybe it should stay that way.
Or maybe Zyproxen finally works. And this really is what we've been waiting for.
He's got her. He can tell from the long, unbroken stare she gives him.
I'll give you 2 pairs, she finally says. That's generous.
And unnecessary, he thinks, which means there's a catch. 1's for her. The other's for Dylan. He's to wear it at all times. The minute he takes it off, I'll blow this whole thing apart. He knows better than to ask what blow this whole thing apart means. He's already relieved she didn't propose another alternative to wipe the slate clean.
I'm sure that'll be fine, he says.
Make sure, so we can be confident this isn't a waste of our time.
I will, he says.
She nods, opens the file on Charlotte Rowe, and stands. As much as he hates being dismissed like this, his father also taught him that one of the keys to good salesmanship was also one of the keys to good negotiation. Never sell through the close.
Cole, Julia calls when he reaches the door.
He gives her his full attention again.
No matter what this turns into, she says,
make sure Dylan has no exit plan this time. 28.
The expansive view from the redwood deck Marty's attached to his trailer relaxes Luke a little, helps him take his first real deep breaths since the moment Charlie decided to stop traffic outside the library.
There aren't a lot of houses in the grassy hills on the eastern side of the valley, so he's not used to gazing down at his hometown from this angle. The town below looks like a tiny circuit board floating in a sea of ink, and across the valley the mountains are coal black. Their peaks, which usually appear gentle and sloping, are etched against the darkening blue of the western sky. At their base, the street he lives on now is a slender fringe of lights. By the time Marty emerges from the front door of his trailer, promised cup of coffee in hand, Luke's reasonably confident he might be able to form a coherent sentence again. But when he takes the heavy ceramic mug from Marty's grip
his hands shake.
He drinks from it too fast to catch the odor of whatever Marty spiked it with.
Whiskey?
Luke asks after a few swallows.
You?
Always keep a bottle around to deal with newbies,
Marty says.
Big Book of AA recommends it. DTs are a bitch. Sometimes there's no other way. Not everyone can afford a fancy detox or rehab. Sometimes they gotta make do with Uncle Marty's sofa.
Love seat's more like it, Luke thinks. He got a glimpse inside the trailer when he used the bathroom earlier. The place is immaculate, not quite as cramped as it seemed from the outside. His own vices have never reduced him to wedging himself onto another man's love seat for a night or two, or seven. Not yet, anyway. But what are his vices? Anger? Regret? Arrogance? Do those even count, or should he be more worried about his tortilla chip intake? Marty leans against the deck rail, pops a piece of gum into his mouth.
Nicotine gum. Quit the smokes 5 years ago. I'll quit the gum any day now. Promise.
He smiles and chews.
Thank you, Luke says.
He's not sure what he's thanking Marty for exactly. The coffee, the spot of whiskey, or for going easier on him now that he's clearly wrecked by the knowledge of what Charlotte can do. Of what that drug can do, Luke corrects himself. In Charlotte. The truck was the least of it. Watching her kick over a tree with one foot, then pull a fence post the size of a man out of the ground, all in the quiet serenity of a vast open field, and not some crazy science lab, was harder to take. He's not sure why. He's not quite sure of anything anymore, except for one thing. He's embarrassed to be this beside himself. But if it's transformed Marty from protective dad to nursemaid, that's cool, at least. Cooler than having Marty treat him like some punk out to destroy Charlie's life. He closes his eyes for a minute or two. Listens to the poplar trees around the property making sounds like dry hands rubbing together.
When she showed me what it could do, what she could do on that stuff, I whizzed myself a little,
Marty says.
I get it. No, I mean literally. She and Kayla, her attorney, they were jumping up and down like they're at some campus women's meeting, and I'm sitting there trying to keep more than a few drops from spilling out.
Luke just stares at him. Marty stares back. When he realizes Marty isn't kidding, he cracks up. Then Marty cracks up too. The trailer's front door opens and out steps Dr. Brewerton, who introduced herself to Luke earlier with a handshake twice as strong as his own. Her hair's a salt and pepper page boy cut. Her Ralph Lauren men's dress shirt hugs her stout frame.
Something funny out here?
She asks.
Everything's serious when you're here, Doc,
Marty says with a wink.
Cute.
She laces her stethoscope around her neck.
You want to tell me what she took? She didn't take anything,
Marty says.
She thinks she got slipped something. All right. Well, I didn't see much evidence of it, to be frank. Her blood pressure's slightly elevated. Heart rate's the same, but not by much. Bruising on her arm looks to be about a week old, so I'm guessing that's not related to whatever she got slipped today.
Try 4 hours old, Luke thinks. He stares at the deck floor to keep these thoughts from the good doctor's view.
No, it's not,
Marty says.
What were her symptoms this afternoon? Racing heart,
Marty lies.
Feeling kind of manic, I guess. She said it was like she'd downed a whole pot of coffee in several minutes, but she hadn't had any caffeine all day. Exactly the words she used,
Dr. Brewerton says.
Yeah, well, they should be. I'm just quoting her. People usually slip women things that slow them down, not speed them up. I'm not in the habit of drugging women, so I wouldn't know.
Marty, the doctor says.
What?
You sponsored me through my divorce from my husband and my marriage to my first wife.
You really think you can't trust me with what's going on here?
There's not more to this story, Marcia. She was feeling weird and we just wanted to get her checked out is all.
All right. Well, will you convince her to let me take her blood? That injury to her arm was clearly major. It could have left her with an infection that explains some of her symptoms today.
So you asked her to take her blood and she said no?
Marty asks.
Dr. Brewerton nods.
Because she figures there's a trace of something in her blood Dylan Fuckface and his benefactors won't want the world to see.
Well, then there's probably no convincing her.
Marty gives the woman a sheepish smile.
With a weary frown, she looks back and forth between the two men, then sighs. Okay. You asked me to see if there was any reason she should be admitted to a hospital, and I'm not seeing one. The symptoms you describe appear to be gone, and nothing about her vitals is alarming. No restricted movement from the injury, either, or from any kind of blockage or stroke. Obviously, I can't do the kind of tests a hospital could, which is why it's always advisable to go to an ER for tachycardia or the like. But that's the best I can do in your trailer.
Thanks, Marcia.
She nods, grunts, and steps off the porch. As soon as she crosses the bottom step, she stops and turns.
And I'll just say this, gentlemen, and don't feel like you need to say anything back. If you all are seriously worried about her and you're not taking her to the hospital because you're afraid of whoever did that to her arm, you all are being damn fools. Because there's resources. That's all I'm saying. Good night.
Marty nods. Luke nods. Then they sit there in silence as her Chevy Tahoe pulls out of the driveway and then downhill toward town.
How is that possible?
Luke asks.
How's what possible?
Normal blood pressure and heart rate after what I watched her do all afternoon.
The miracle of modern pharmaceuticals, I guess.
Marty smacks his gum, probably in an effort to draw out more nicotine. Suddenly, a car whisks past the Tahoe headed in their direction. It's halfway between boxy and streamlined, with slender headlights and a shiny silver paint job. And it's way nicer than most of the vehicles Luke sees around town. By the time it pulls into the driveway, he can make out the Audi logo on the grill. The stylishly dressed black woman who steps from behind the wheel looks vaguely familiar. Like she might have played a minor role in a TV show he used to watch as a kid. Charlotte's lawyer. Trina's lawyer before she became Charlie. He'd monitored the news coverage around her lawsuit, seen footage of them walking in and out of courtrooms together. She looks just as confident and put together now, even though all she's doing is mounting the front steps of Marty's trailer. She turns her attention to Luke.
You must be the asshole from high school.
Really? Luke says.
Still? It's only been a day,
Marty says.
Since high school? Luke asks.
You know what I mean,
Marty says.
Forgive Mr. Prescott's jumpy nerves, Kayla. He got his first show of what Charlie's capable of this afternoon.
So the circle widens. Kayla glares at him. Or maybe it's not a glare. Maybe it's just how she looks at people. People she thinks are assholes.
Or, Marty offers, it stays wide because someone's refusing to stay away. I thought Charlie called off your background check this afternoon.
Yeah, well, I figured since I know who's behind this, I should share my thoughts. Even though Charlotte's convinced we're all being tracked by drones now.
I'm listening,
Marty says.
So am I,
Luke adds.
I found a Dylan Cody who served in the United States Marine Corps before becoming a Navy SEAL. He was stationed with SEAL Team 3 out of Coronado, but not for very long.
Let me guess. He got lured away by something lucrative and more private,
Luke says.
Not quite.
He was accepted to Harvard University, where he pursued a concentration in chemical and physical biology before graduating with honors. Then he went on to get his PhD.
Concentration?
Marty asks.
I thought they were called majors.
Really?
Luke asks.
That's where your focus goes right now.
Kayla seems pleased by Luke's remark, which pleases Luke. He's not interested in trying to win somebody else over today.
What did he get his PhD in?
Luke asks.
Neuroscience.
Shortly thereafter, he was hired by a company called Graydon Pharmaceuticals. Ever heard of them?
Doesn't matter. You've probably been prescribed at least two of their drugs in your lifetime.
I knew a drug company was behind this, Luke says.
What did he do there? Marty asks.
Nothing, Kayla says, as if she doesn't believe her own answer.
Brilliant guy, gorgeous. Hired out of Harvard, a veteran of Special Forces. I mean, drug companies are all about marketing, and this one hires Superman in scrubs, and then never lets him appear at a public function on Graydon's behalf. You'd think they would have made him the face of something.
Or he was working on something they didn't want anyone to know about, Luke says.
Sounds about right, Marty adds.
What about before then? Luke asks.
Before Graydon?
No, before the Marines.
That's when I got called off, Kayla says. So what do you think? You think this intel's good enough for a drop-in, even though she didn't want me digging?
For your own safety, Marty points out.
That's not why she called you off today, Luke says.
Kayla's eyebrows go up. Marty gives him a similar expression.
I mean, maybe that's part of it, but it's not the only reason.
If Charlie's refusing help from someone this smart and capable, maybe letting Kayla and Marty in on her plans is for her own good.
Yeah. And remember what she did the last time you tried to do something you thought was for her own good?
I'm listening, Kayla says.
So am I, Marty adds.
Sorry, Charlie.
She's cutting you out so she doesn't have to tell you what she's planning to do.
A little while later, they're all seated inside Marty's trailer, and Charlotte's looking at him like she wants to punch a hole through his chest the way she did that truck's grill. Is the 3-hour window thing for real, he wonders, or was she just trying to ease his rattled nerves? At Luke's request, they've powered off their cell phones and placed them inside Marty's mailbox at the mouth of the driveway. A skilled hacker, he explained, could use their handheld devices to listen in on everything they're saying. Kayla didn't disagree, Charlotte didn't have a strong opinion since she was still without a new cell phone, and Marty, whose bookshelf includes titles like Alien Conspiracy, Secrets of the Trilateral Commission, and Loch Ness Unchained, already had a little piece of paper taped over the camera on his desktop computer. He still shut the thing down and powered off his Wi-Fi network as well.
I don't get it, Marty says, for the second time.
He's leaning against the kitchen counter, arms crossed over his chest, nicotine gum forgotten in one corner of his mouth.
Is he acting dumb?
Maybe he's just in shock. Charlie couldn't have been any clearer.
What's not to get? Kayla asks.
She's on one end of the love seat, bent elbow braced against the arm, resting her face in her open palm as if it's the only thing keeping her head from falling apart.
The plan, Marty says. What's the plan? I mean, it's one thing to want to go after this guy, but how are you going to find him?
That's your brother's job, right? Kayla asks Luke.
You think your brother's gonna be able to find out who's killed those women with just a few keystrokes?
Marty asks.
No, I don't.
He answers. And why not? He's touched ice blocks warmer than Charlie's voice.
He's good, but he's not that good.
Says who? Charlie asks.
Says me.
He found a white-collar criminal living under an assumed name in Australia, and he hacked a satellite to do it.
Fundamentally, he knew who he was looking for, Luke responded. And he exploited a backdoor in a telecommunications company, a backdoor the company has since publicly acknowledged and closed.
Sounds pretty skilled to me, Kayla says.
Everything about this is different. Back then he had his target's height, weight, everything about his mannerisms, physical appearance, and tics. It may sound irrelevant, but that's all pivotal in a hack, because it allows you to predict what passwords they pick, how they might try to move money, possible aliases.
Who's the expert in hacking again?
Marty asks.
I looked into it because I wanted to know how my brother had destroyed his life.
You don't know he's destroyed his life,
Marty says.
He could be in Tahiti covered in swimsuit models right now.
Yeah, 'cause he was always a big hit with swimsuit models.
The point is, the only way Bailey's been able to pull off something like this is when he had a body of knowledge about a specific individual.
He doesn't have that here. He's got a ghost, just like the cops. Whatever methods he does use to try to find the mask maker, there's no reason to believe they'll be any better than what the LAPD's using right now.
They could be faster, Kayla says,
given that he won't have to deal with warrants and all.
The best he'll be able to do is hack LAPD and get you as much of the case file as he can.
Maybe the BSU profile on the guy, if there is one.
Well, that's super illegal, Kayla mutters. But she's staring at the floor vacantly, as if strict concepts of legality don't mean as much to her as they did the day before, but she's still obligated to reference them now and then.
BSU?
Marty asks.
Behavioral Science Unit of the FBI, Kayla says.
They deal with serial killers. They try to deal with serial killers, Charlie says.
What does that mean? Luke asks.
It means two agents from BSU probably flew to L.A. on the taxpayer's dime and spent a few days in their hotel rooms using trendy pop psychology to write some superficial profile, she mimes air quotes, based on a shallow reading of the crime scenes. Now the local cops are leaning on that profile instead of doing their jobs, which is actually investigating the evidence they have. In the process, they'll eliminate way too many potential suspects so they can trim their workload, and the profile, she fires off another set of air quotes, will give them permission to do it.
That's a lot of air quotes there, Trigger,
Marty says.
And a pretty rash dismissal of an esteemed unit of the FBI,
Luke says. Really? Charlie asks. You're going to start defending the FBI?
Look, I get it. You're mad at me for telling them you wanna...
No, I'm sick of people getting tingly over BSU because of Clarice Starling, okay? Have any of you ever read the FBI profile of the Bannings? A crystal ball would have been more help.
I heard they use those too, Kayla says.
Charlie, Luke says.
FBI profiling is a very valid...
The profile ruled out all women, for Christ's sake! It was a female serial killer!
To be fair, she was working in conjunction with a male sexual predator who connected up with many of the points made in the profile,
Luke says. And he wasn't committing the murders. She was.
And by ruling out all women, the profile blinded the local cops to something they should have seen before.
Which was what? Kayla asks. There were no signs of struggle at most of the abduction sites, because the victims, mostly women traveling alone, trusted their abductor. More than they would have trusted any lone man traveling on a back road or hiking through the woods. And they trusted him because he had a woman with him. If the profile had been right and Daniel Banning or some sick freak just like him was acting alone, there's a chance my mother never would have rolled down her car window so fast.
You don't know that, Charlie,
Marty says.
Come on. She had a flat tire in the middle of nowhere, and she was with a baby. She needed any help she could get.
And what about the two girls they beat in their motel room? Kayla asks. Yeah, you mean the ones who didn't think twice about telling the Bannings which cabin they were staying in because a woman was asking?
Luke thinks Charlie might be fighting tears, but he can't tell. She's like a different person now, and it's been that way ever since she showed him what she could do. Surly and embarrassed, as if he's seen her naked and she didn't want him to.
She didn't want you to see what she could do, genius. You forced her to show you when you tried to call Mona.
The Bannings were an exceptional case,
he says.
By any standards.
So is the mask maker,
Charlie says.
And I don't need an FBI profile to find him.
Well, good, 'cause I think that's the best Bailey's gonna be able to do.
That and the case files from LAPD.
Fine, she says. Luke knows he should take a breath. Maybe a few, at his house, with a beer. But instead he hears himself say,
What do you mean, fine? I mean, what does that even mean, here?
He sounds like he used to when he was 8 years old, and his mother told him he couldn't have a third Coca-Cola. Only when he sees the way everyone's staring at him does he realize he shot to his feet.
Yes, Luke, fine. If that's all Bailey can get, I will find the guy on my own. Alone if I have to.
And then what?
Marty asks.
You're gonna burst through the walls of his house like the Kool-Aid man or Kool-Aid girl or whatever?
Kayla says, Shut up, Marty.
It's a good question,
Luke says.
I don't disagree,
Kayla responds.
She just likes telling me to shut up,
Marty says.
The answer's no, Charlie says. I am not going to burst through his walls like the Kool-Aid man.
What are you going to do?
Luke asks.
I'm going to make sure he never kills again.
How?
Luke says, with such anger in his voice it makes something wild dance in Charlie's eyes. So she has a plan, he realizes. She's not flying blind with desperation as her driving wind. She knows exactly what she wants to do. She doesn't think he can handle it.
Oh my God, Kayla says softly. You're gonna do it just like the bar, aren't you?
You're gonna bait the guy. You're gonna try to get him to take you just like one of his victims.
Charlie's answer is in her silence.
You're out of your fucking mind,
Luke says. And you're free to go at any time.
Oh yeah? Now that you've got my brother working for you.
Give me a break. He agreed to help me because he wanted to. You didn't talk him into anything.
And you could be sending him after these people, not using him to work with them.
I am not working with these people, and if you really think your brother, by himself, is going to be able to take on a corporation the size of Graydon Pharmaceuticals and whoever they can afford to hire, you're the crazy one.
She gets to her feet and moves into the tiny kitchen. Marty steps out of her way, riveted, it seems, by the confrontation building before him.
This is just crazy and desperate. You've got no idea what you're doing or why you're doing it.
Oh, really? I thought you knew exactly what I was doing. I'm out to prove to the world I'm not a serial killer. Still, wasn't that what you said back at the library?
That's not what I...
It is what you said. It's exactly what you said, and if you didn't mean it, maybe you're the desperate one right now. What happened to the guy who wanted to help me no matter what?
He's still trying.
Oh, bullshit. You're freaking out because you can't handle what I can do.
Never should have told you or shown you any of it. You're not doing anything, Charlotte. The drug is doing it. Dylan's drug is doing it, and you're choosing to take it again for reasons that are certifiably insane. Am I the only one who feels the need to weigh in here?
Weighing in is what we're calling this? Kayla asks.
All right, fine. So it's gonna be all about my tone then, or how I'm not saying it in the right way.
Charlie answers by turning her back on him and opening the refrigerator door. Is she actually looking for something inside, or is it just an act?
So, tell me, Charlie, Trina, whatever it is, tell me why you're going after the mask maker.
She slams the refrigerator door shut with enough force to shake the trailer. Luke can feel the pulse of terror that moves through all three of them, the fear that maybe the drug isn't out of her system, or maybe this is some new episode. Charlie either doesn't notice, or she doesn't care. Because I want to.
That's why. Because if these people are going to force me to be their guinea pig, then by God, I'm going to use what they've given me the way I want.
I'm going to find the man who did that to those women, and I'm going to look right into his eyes when he realizes that I am the end of him. And I will not spend another second justifying that to some prick who's on an apology tour because his life has hit the skids and he's just now realizing he's too big of an asshole to make any friends.
Marty winces. Kayla swallows. Her words strike a blow to his gut, and the pain that radiates outward while phantom and fleeting fills him with a bewildering urge. It feels almost like a craving, this acute desire to return to that moment in his Jeep when he reached for her, because he thought she was about to lose it. The moment when his hand made it no farther than the gear shift before she rested hers atop it. Why would he think of that moment now, when her words have slugged him this hard? It's like his brain's convinced there's something he can squeeze from the memory and apply to his wounds like a balm.
Oh, shit, dude, he thinks. Oh, shit.
He's familiar with this voice in his head, the voice that warns him away from serious risks, the voice that sounds just like his freshman year roommate, Reggie, who had a particular steady way of pointing out when things were about to go seriously off the rails, like when he realized the hot girl visiting their room was about to turn psycho, or the coffee they'd been drinking out of the bottom of the pot had been sitting there for days.
Oh, shit, dude. You are totally falling for—
The words fly from him before Reggie's voice can finish his sentence.
Well, shit. You didn't just rent Dylan a space in your head. You bought him a house there. Good luck with your treatment, burning girl.
Get out. Works for me, he answers. But there's a tremor in his voice. Kayla cocks her head to one side, sympathy flashing in her eyes.
Don't worry. I'll keep all your crazy secrets. And if Bailey doesn't find a way to get in touch with you himself, I'll let you know. If, you know, you're not off hunting terrorists by then because it's what you want.
He's moving so fast, he's startled by the sound of his own footsteps punching the wooden steps out front. Startled to suddenly be speeding downhill toward the valley, holding the steering wheel in a white-knuckled grip. He keeps swallowing, but nothing gets rid of the lump in his throat. And that look Kayla gave him, the one that seemed surprised by the level of emotion in his voice, replays on a loop inside his mind. He can feel the cold, analytical parts brushing off their spectacles and preparing to lecture him the way he'd just tried to lecture Charlotte. Preparing to explain away his bewildering mixture of hurt and embarrassment, his acute sense of rejection. On the one hand, it's probably shock. Some people, most people, would have full-on lost their minds once they saw what that drug can do. So all things considered, maybe he's doing pretty well, thank you. And who would be surprised to learn that one afternoon of friendly conversation and criminal conspiracy wasn't enough to put all the years of ill will between him and Charlotte at bay? But there had been a moment back there on the porch, after he'd managed to steady his hands, around the time he and Marty had started to shoot the shit, when he'd felt more settled inside his own skin than he'd been for weeks, months even, when he'd felt like a part of something. Included.
Well, that's gone now, isn't it?
Get out, she'd said to him.
Can't get any clearer than that.
Yeah, and she said it because you jumped down her throat, lectured her, and then when she disagreed, you told her how to think. And those final words. God, they hurt. They hurt. Because she is right. He doesn't have any friends, and he's not sure how to make any. This only became clear to him once he was separated from his ambitions. Scratch that. This only became a problem once he was separated from his ambitions. There have been times since he returned to Altamira when his loneliness has felt like a weight on his chest. He knows it's too heavy to remove on his own, but on most days he's too proud to ask for help. So he lies to himself and says, tomorrow will be the day. Tomorrow will be the day he'll go someplace and just sit and see who talks to him first, and hope that the first stirrings of chit-chat with a stranger might reveal the seeds of a new life. A new life with new friends and a new vision for his future he can be proud of. And she could see all this, of course. Maybe because he'd told her things about himself. Or maybe because he wore this truth about himself like clothes. Or maybe because she'd always been able to see these types of things about people. Isn't that part of why he'd been such a dick to her back in high school? Why he'd fixated on her? Because what she'd been through had taught her things about the world most teenagers didn't know. Or if they did know them, the knowledge had put them in a mental hospital. The fact is, even at 16, Trina Pierce, Burning Girl Charlotte Rowe had been the type of person who could see through your bullshit, your poses. And that had made her scary and threatening, and also special. Remarkable. Back then he'd chosen fear. Fear and cruelty. But ever since then he'd felt himself tilting in the other direction. Now he's wobbling back and forth between the two like a metronome, and all he wants is his own shitty sofa in his own shitty house with a less than shitty beer. He's turning into his driveway when his old roommate's warning voice speaks up again. Uh-oh, dude. You're totally into her, and you probably always have been. 29. After Luke leaves them in stilted silence, Marty says,
"This is my fault."
"It's not your fault," Charlotte answers.
"If I hadn't made you go see him..."
"You didn't make me. You wanted to check him out, that's all." "I'm the one who wanted to see him." "Because I thought you were full of it," she thinks.
"So," Kayla interjects, "you really think he'll be able to keep all this a secret?"
"Will you?" Charlie asks.
"Attorney-client privilege."
Her smile is strained. "Seriously, though?" Charlie asks. Kayla clears her throat, studies the ceiling while she works her jaw. Charlie's seen her perform this trio of movements before. It's her usual routine when she's trying to collect thoughts she doesn't like.
"Well, considering you haven't made me aware of any intention to commit a crime..."
"The hacking doesn't count?" Marty asks.
"She's not doing any hacking," Kayla answers.
"She simply asked someone with a history of hacking to find someone for her, that's all."
"Not just someone." Charlotte feels guilty Kayla's resorting to verbal acrobatics to defend her. In fact, she'll feel guilty if Kayla stays here much longer.
"True," Kayla says. "So I guess what it comes down to are the specifics of what you're going to do to this guy once you find him."
"You heard her," Marty says. "She's going to stop him from killing."
"Yeah, I heard her, and it's vague."
"Well," Charlie says, "when it comes to you, maybe I should keep it that way."
"Suit yourself."
Kayla gets to her feet. She reaches into her briefcase and hands Charlie a slender manila folder.
"That's everything I found on Graydon and Dylan Cody before you told me to stop. Most of it's public. Some of it took a little digging. Do what you will with it."
She's pissed. Charlie can tell. "Kayla, there's only one person in my life who's done better by me than you, and that's my grandmother. I can't drag you into the middle of this.
If you lost your career, I'd never forgive myself."
She nods, studies Charlie's face for a bit, her eyes unreadable.
"That's fair, I guess."
She surprises Charlotte with a strong, quick hug.
"You know where I am if you need me."
"So do they," Charlotte thinks, the pit of her stomach going cold as Kayla pulls away. Her lawyer's got one foot out the door when Charlotte calls to her.
"Do you think I'm crazy?"
"No," she answers.
I think this whole thing's crazy and you're just adapting.
Night, guys.
I'm gonna miss you, Mothra,
Marty says. It takes Charlotte a second to remember Marty's comment from the night before, the one comparing him and Kayla to Godzilla and Mothra.
Huh? Kayla asks.
Ignore him, Charlotte says. Kayla takes her advice. A minute or two later, they're listening to her car leave the driveway, as Charlotte rifles through the contents of the file. Her attention catches on a color printout of some magazine profile of Graydon's CEO, probably because it has the most photos. The man in question is seated on the edge of a sofa, in a sprawling office that's all glass, steel, sunlight, and cream-colored upholstery. His blazing blue eyes practically bore a hole in the paper. The rest of his face is a collection of bones so sharp it looks like a peck on the cheek from him could draw blood. No suit and tie for this billionaire. But he doesn't look like a scooter-riding tech mogul either. Rather, his powder-blue dress shirt, the top three buttons undone over a hairless chest, along with his black designer jeans, make him look like a dad just home from the law firm on a network television show. Cole Graydon's his name, and the first few paragraphs of the article make it clear he inherited the company from his late father. No mention of the fact that he looks so tightly wound his head might pop off at any second and go spinning across the floor. Maybe it's just the picture. Or maybe not. Charlotte recognizes the look. It's been hers for years.
Luke won't blab about any of this.
Marty started reading over her shoulder.
Not with his brother in the middle of it now.
Here's hoping. He uses his fingertips to slide the papers she's not reading out from under the magazine article.
And what about you? She asks.
What about me, darling?
Do you want out of this?
So your grandmother can rise up out of the grave and wring my neck? No, thanks.
She was cremated.
Fine, tear me apart on the wind, then.
Seriously, Marty.
When did you get this idea in your head that you're some kind of burden to me?
Never mind.
Don't answer that, because I don't care. Let's just get it out. Let's just reach in there with whatever it takes and get that thought off your mind for good.
She studies his face, looking for signs of doubt. Instead, she finds a warm, sincere smile that softens her chest. He opens his arms. She steps into them. And for a while, she just leans into the embrace. Marty, do you think I was too hard on him?
He was out of line. He doesn't know you well enough to say all that shit. And when he called you burning girl, I almost knocked his teeth out.
Still. He kisses her on the forehead, takes a step back, but doesn't release her shoulders.
You got enough on your plate right now without having to worry about Luke Prescott.
Right, she answers, but she's not sure she's convinced.
Speaking of which... What do we do now, just wait for Bailey to get back to us?
Pretty much. And pray that Dylan and his friends let us. He nods, turns to the fridge.
Got your sandwich from the copper pot. You hungry?
I'll eat it later.
Okay. Try to get some rest, Charlie. I know Marcia didn't find anything wrong with you, but I don't figure wearing yourself out while you're taking this stuff is going to be a good idea.
She nods, but she doesn't rest. Nightmares aren't her problem. They never have been. She suffers from a different kind of nocturnal affliction. Sometimes, like tonight, right when she's about to nod off, some horrifying image blazes big as a drive-in movie screen in her mind, and the end result leaves her feeling like she's been snatched back from the edge of sleep by a giant claw. Sometimes it's a detail from one of Abigail's murders, committed just a few yards from where she was probably filling in a coloring book with crayons at the time. And sometimes it's Abigail, clawing her way through a window, gripping the blade of her Bowie knife in her teeth, Her thick, golden hair fanned out around her head like a lion's mane. Other times, her kidnapper waits patiently on the living room sofa, or hides behind the shower curtain, or tucks herself into the kitchen's deepest pool of shadow.